couch of potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Smallfoot, Night School, Hellfest, and The Man with the Gun. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Solo, a Star Wars story. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is a sad piece, and that is Al Matthews, best known for playing Sergeant Appone in Aliens, has died at age 75. Now, the cause of death as of right now is unknown. But I just wanted to take a little bit of a time to shout out to this guy because he didn't have an illustrious or huge career in acting, but he did have an indelible one, being the sergeant in Aliens, of course, who has to wake up all the Marines and get them going. And but yes, Al Matthews, sad to see him go at age 75. The next piece of news is, of course, another one that hit big this week, and that was that Bill Cosby got sentenced. And not much of a surprise on this one because we saw where it was going after the trial. He got 3 to 10 years in prison and was labeled, deemed by the judge, a violent sexual predator who was once America's dad, is now America's felon, and he is reported for duty in the prison. And we'll see how, he was like 81. So who knows if he's going to make it through this whole thing. 3 years, yeah, you can. But 10 years in prison starting at 81, he may spend the rest of his life behind bars. And, that's what you get for drugging and raping people. 30 years ago, he was at the top of his game. He had the number one TV show. He was a huge hit, and he was popular with kids and families. If you had told me 30 years ago that Donald Trump would be president, Bill Cosby would be in jail, and Betty White would still be alive, I would have said you were crazy. The next piece of news is Mel Gibson has been tapped to write and direct a remake of The Wild Bunch. And less interesting about what he's doing, and more interesting about him making movies again. Now, he tried to get back on the scenes with being in Jodie Foster's movie, The Beaver, and he had shown up in other things. He was in that Machete Kills. So he had tried to show up in other movies, one of the Expendable films. But then they had him step back behind the camera, and he directed Hacksaw Ridge a couple years ago, which was one of my favorite movies of the year. And it showed that Mel Gibson, aside from his personal beliefs and some real shenanigans that happened on a very public stage, he still has what it takes to make a movie. And this is going to be a good test of beyond the Me Too movement, because I think we've gotten points where we're saying somebody like Harvey Weinstein shouldn't be allowed in the industry anymore because of criminal activity and use of power, and people like Kevin Spacey, who's had that fall from grace directly tied to sexual assault charges. Mel Gibson was sort of swept under the rug before the whole Me Too movement, and his stuff, while it marginally has to do with that, it's also just people saying, well, anti-Semite, and he's kind of a jerk and all that. This is going to be a good test to see how much, not Hollywood, but how much the American people forgive people for bad behavior and at what degree that bad behavior has been. And, you have people like Chris Hardwick, who was accused of certain things. But then also, what bearing does that have on him doing his job and Chris Hardwick's back on TV? And I think you're seeing, what people can be forgiven for, at least in entertainment. And we'll see if Mel Gibson can weather that storm or if there's still people who are going to essentially not watch his movies. Speaking of which, you've got James Gunn news and the fact that, according to Sean Gunn, who's James Gunn's brother, and he was in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie as one of the henchmen, he has said that Disney is going to be using James Gunn's script for Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And that's important because that's been in development. They've been working on that, and that has been obviously how it ties into other existing Marvel movies like, say, The Avengers Infinity War. And that was a big question on people's mind. Would they use the script? Because here's my issue. Even with these unfortunate and inappropriate tweets that Gunn had released a decade ago, is it okay to use his script? Because if it's not okay for him to be director, why is it okay to use his script? And that's where I think Disney is finding itself between a rock and a hard place, or Marvel in particular, but Disney running the show. And my thing is, hey, if you can use a script, you should be able to use him as a director. And I think part of it is Disney hasn't named a new director, which I find interesting. The fact that they haven't named a new director, I think they're trying to wait this out and see if anyone really cares. And if it leaks out there that they're using James Gunn's script and there's no outrage, maybe they will hire him back as a director. They either are having trouble finding somebody to be a director, or they're just sort of marking time and saying, you know what, let's wait this out and then rehire him anyways, quietly. And if nobody cares, then, oh well, then that was just a blip. And that's one of those outrage moments that you don't have to worry about. Now, the rumor is he's definitely gone. The word from Disney is they're not hiring him back. My question is, if you're not hiring him back, why are you using a script? And why haven't you named another director? And I think they're just kind of taking a breather on this one and seeing if he's going to have lasting problems from this or if it's something that he can overcome. So I don't think the book's closed on the James Gunn saga yet. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Bumblebee, which opens on Christmas.
Oh my God. What are you?
So you have no idea where he came from?
No idea.
Well,
there's a war raging on our planet. If this criminal isn't found, that war may find its way here.
Is there anyone that can help you? Do you have a family? Oh, me.
I can't remember whether I covered this before or not in the trailer park, because these Transformer movies can sometimes just be explosions and the sound of car parts moving around and transforming. It doesn't make good radio. It makes good cinema, but not good radio. But let's talk about this really quickly, because I have to say, this may be the first Transformer movies after five of them that I actually kind of want to see, and looks like it can be coherent. Part of it is the trailer. You can tell what's going on. It doesn't look like just a stupid slow motion beer commercial with no plot or characters, which is essentially what the other five Transformers movies are. Those things are freaking terrible they look cool, but from a story and plot and everything else that makes a movie standpoint, they're bad movies. This one actually looks kind of good. My worry on this one is it's going to be the first time they gave the Transformers franchise to somebody outside of Michael Bay, and you're going to end up with a film that doesn't have that big bombastic billion-dollar return. And they're going to say, oh, well, we need to have Michael Bay back in the franchise. I just hope that this does well enough to prove that somebody other than Michael Bay should be making these films. The next one I want to talk about really quick is Dark Phoenix, which opens on February 14th.
I came looking for answers.
They can't begin to comprehend what you are.
She's changing.
And what?
You didn't come here looking for answers. You came here looking for permission. She's all rage, pain, and it's all coming out at once.
Jean lost control.
This is your fault, Charles.
This is a new X-Men movie. It is retelling the Dark Phoenix saga, which was marginally told in X-Men 3, The Last Stand. Much to many people's consternation, because it's not a very accurate telling of it, and this is apparently a little more authentic. It's sort of doing this weird retconning where some things are associated with the new X-Men, some of them are associated with the old one. It's the way comic books have always been written, where things don't always shakily hold together. It is also after the big time travel moment in Days of Future Past, so they can reboot everything, but of course, you have different characters and actors. So I don't know. This one looks really good. I just hope that it fits and it works in the franchise and it is not something that's too confusing or just a throwaway film like that X-Men Apocalypse was. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Night School and a quick little tease for a special project.
Yeah.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Before I jump into the movie reviews, I want to do a little bit of a special feature here. And it is a giveaway I'm going to be doing for Halloween. It is a freebie for my loyal fans and my loyal audience out there. Not everybody knows this about me, but I used to write short fiction, genre fiction back in the 90s and had some published here and there throughout the science fiction and horror communities. Back in the 90s, I wrote a column called Surreal World in a magazine called Pirate Writings that then eventually changed its name to Fantastic. And it looked at like Men in Black kind of stuff. This was when the X-Files was huge. So I was, you know, looking at alien autopsies and the Montauk Project and reverse speech and all this kind of stuff, the stuff you'd hear on Art Bell late at night. And I also published a bunch of stories here and there. In fact, I got to a point where I was a name you could put on the cover. And they did. They actually put me on the cover of Aboriginal Science Fiction. Too bad I didn't actually have a story in there. For some reason, this story was published that's not mine, but it was attributed to me. I got credit for it. And you see it in bibliographies if you would do a search on like Locus or something like that. But I was on the cover. So I was big enough to be put on the cover. I just didn't have a story that went in that magazine. It's really funny. I have a copy of it. Cover story. This new fiction by Kevin M. Carr. And it's actually not me. Unless there was another Kevin M. Carr floating around who published this. I have several books that are on Amazon. There's horror novels. Normally, I'm in the genre stuff. I've always, as you know, I like horror movies. So I have horror and science fiction. It's not anything. And I'm not trying to write the great American novel or anything like that. So one of the things, I have written a new story and I'm releasing it in audiobook format. The story is called Bedridden. And on October 1st, as a Halloween present, because of course, October for me is a month of horror movies and horror stories. And I try and watch a horror movie a day in October. But I thought I'd release this. It's about 10,000 words, or it takes about an hour to listen to. I'm releasing it for free. So it's coming through the podcast stream rather than buying it through iTunes as a recorded book. I wanted to kind of have it as an early Halloween present for my listeners. It will be available through the Fat Guys at the Movies podcast stream. And the way to get that is just go to iTunes and search Fat Guys at the Movies. We'll pop right up. And either subscribe to it would be great, or just download that particular podcast. Like I said, it'll be available on Monday. So being October, that it's not going to be available at the end of September. It's going to be early on Monday. Or you can just go to fatguysatthemovies.com, listen to it live on the site, or download it directly to your device that way. Now, of course, if you listen to it, send feedback. If you like it, you can always visit Amazon and search Kevin Carr as an author and find my books. There'll be a link on the page to take you to my author page on Amazon.com. And if you want to download some things and read some horror stories, I've got zombie books. I've got an anthology of horror stories. I've got an anthology of science fiction stories. Those are things that you can check out. Happy Halloween to my audience. I've been doing this for more than 10 years on the radio. I've been doing this for more than 5 years in national syndication. So this is a little freebie. Thanks to my audience. And if it goes well and people like it, give me some feedback and we may drop a couple more audiobooks onto the feed just as sort of like a thank you to the audience. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now let's jump into the movie reviews with Night School. Kevin Hart plays a high school dropout who has to go to night school in order to get his GED.
But I'm here now to get my GED.
You would have to go to night school.
Okay, night school people.
You're the night school teacher? She's not like the teachers that we had back in the day.
This woman is a brick wall.
School policy, if you don't pass that test, you're out.
Are you trying to get your GED?
Yes.
The issue is, you're clinically dumb.
I knew it.
There's no cure for what you have.
Oh my God. I got learning herpes.
This is yet another Kevin Hart movie. He's got his own little cottage industry. And like they've discovered with other Kevin Hart movies, is Kevin Hart alone can't really carry a movie. He's got to be in there with somebody. He's either got to be a part of a group. Like, he did that ensemble piece about marriage. They go to Vegas. But also, he's been doing quite well when they partner him with somebody. Like, he did the ride-along movies with Ice Cube. Or he did Central Intelligence with Dwayne Johnson. Well, the person they're pairing him with now is Tiffany Haddish, who made a huge splash in Girls Trip. No pun intended. If you've seen that movie, you get that joke. But it's also directed by Malcolm Lee, who directed Girls Trip. So he's got a hand in kind of really getting Tiffany Haddish seen nationwide. I mean, she got like award nominations for Girls Trip. She hit big. And we're in the point now where she got enough buzz, and now she's getting as many roles as she can. She does have a danger of getting overexposed, because I think this is like the fifth Tiffany Haddish movie that's come out this year, and there's like another one coming out in like a month. But more power to her. Do what you can to get noticed and get on the map. The biggest problem is pairing Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish. I think both of them are funny. I think both of them are talented. The problem that it is both of their shticks the same thing. They are sort of indignant, then they start getting mad, and they start getting loud, and they start talking fast, and they start yelling insults at each other. That's kind of how they each do their comedy, and they're both very similar, actually, in their delivery. As opposed to Ice Cube in the Ride Along movies is a totally different shtick than Kevin Hart. He's laid back, he's cool, he's got swagger, he's a little more gangsta. I know I sounded really cool saying that. But you would never say that they kind of have the same approach to comedy. And that's why they worked well together. That's why they worked in that movie. Even when he did, what was that movie with Will Ferrell going to prison? I forget what it, Get Hard, I think was what it was called. He's essentially the physical polar opposite of Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell's tall and as pale as can be. Kevin Hart's incredibly short. They looked very different on screen. Their comedy delivery is very different. Tiffany Haddish, her delivery is just too similar to Kevin Hart. So you put them in the movie together and they just end up shouting at each other. And that's less funny than somebody working off of somebody else. The other problem with Night School is just, in general, the writing and the rest of the cast. It has some people that are nice little side players, like Mary Lynn Retchkub and Rob Riggle. They're funny in these like side bits, but they're just not given great material in this movie. There's a couple funny moments individual, and you see a lot of that in the trailer, or at least stuff that leads into it. But it's not cohesive. This movie, it's sort of like he's sort of thrown into this classroom, and the classroom is kind of like this Pixar group of insane people. You know how like always in a Pixar movie, there's a group of side characters that, you know, like all the toys in Toy Story or the fish in the fish tank in Finding Nemo. And that's kind of what they play, but they're just not that good. It also has stuff that they play for comedy, like how certain things work, like school in general. And my wife's a teacher. I always get kind of my backup on this kind of stuff, but that's not how school works. And you can't just, it doesn't work that way. And like part of it is he has dyslexia and a couple other learning disabilities, but it's not like he went to school in the early 70s when that stuff was first really getting identified. He was in school in like 2000, 2001. They were identifying dyslexia pretty accurately and consistently just less than 20 years ago. So it just doesn't work pragmatically. It also doesn't always work as a comedy. It has some funny moments. But aside from that, it's really kind of not that good. So I'm going to have to say that Night School kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Smallfoot and Hellfest. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Smallfoot. A Yeti encounters a human and sets out from the safety of his village atop a mountain in the Himalayas to prove the existence of the Smallfoot.
Welcome to the secret headquarters of the SES.
Stands for Smallfoot Exists, suckers.
We have searched the entire mountain trying to find one. And that day has finally arrived.
Smallfoot.
Oh my gosh! It's a Smallfoot!
Where did it go?
Reach into your memory.
It got whisked away on the wind over the cloud.
Which way? Up, sideways?
Down!
Down! Of course!
He saw Smallfoot!
It'd still be out there!
He said it fell from the sky!
This is an animated film, obviously. Well, not obviously. I mean, you could make a Yeti film nowadays and it wouldn't look as goofy as Harry and the Hendersons now. But it's an animated film, and it's whimsical, and it's got songs in it. I think that's kind of interesting that it does have songs in it, because it used to be that animated films always had music in them, always had songs. And I was never into that. I mean, even when I was a kid, and you'd do movies like Cinderella, and they'd have a moment where she's there singing as she's cleaning. That stuff always bored me as a kid. But they often put music in animated films, and that kind of went by the wayside in the 90s, really. Because, of course, you know, by the time they were doing animated full CGI movies like Toy Story, they weren't just making musicals all the time, although you saw that stuff show up every now and then. Of course, obviously, Frozen is a great example of a movie that had multiple music songs in it, but I think that was also a throwback to the Disney princess type films. This one, it has that music to it. It has the big production numbers. And that's where they can really do some neat stuff with the animation. And they don't overload it. I think there's like 3 or 4 songs throughout the entire movie. It's not like you're just going from song to song to song, which sometimes is what sort of irritates me about musicals, is that it's just you're waiting around for the next song to start. But Smallfoot, it's a cute enough movie. I mean, it has whimsical animation. It has decent characters. The actors are really good. The voice actors, of course, you know, Channing Tatum does a good job as the Maiden Yeti, and James Corden does a good job as the Smallfoot he's tracking. I also like the fact that they're making an animated movie that's not just a remake or a sequel of something out there that already exists, or it's not like some fairy tale that we've seen a dozen times. It's its own movie. Now, it's based on a book, but it's not a well-known book. It's not something that, you know, it's not like when Hunger Games was made into a movie, everyone knew the book Hunger Games or Harry Potter, for example. That just happens to be the source material. But in all intents and purposes, it's an original movie. I mean, even though it's not an original screenplay, it's an adaptation. But it's not something we've seen before. And so it's different. And I like that. I like it when animated films give you something different than what you expect. It's a leap, and it's daring, and I think that it's something that they need to do to push the industry farther. And in that sense, it works. There's also some interesting things. If you really want to get goofy on this, you could get overly political with this movie and say that there's messaging there about, you know, believing science, and there's messaging there about not just taking for granted what's you've been told, but to go find out for yourself and to research and to look into things and to question authority and to not be xenophobic and to challenge restrictions of your ancestors and your parents. Just because it's written in a book somewhere does not mean that it's truth. I think there's a lot of stuff there that, you know, the overly political minded can pick that apart and beat their chest and complain about it. So sort of like how, remember when Horton Hears a Who came out and there was this big thing because of some line Horton says, and it's from the original book where he says, you know, a person's a person no matter how small. And somehow that was turned into an abortion debate. And the people who made the movie were like, no, that's not what we were going after. That wasn't the point of the movie. And people sort of appropriated that one phrase and made it political off that. And I fear when I watched Smallfoot, I feared that that's something that people will do with this movie, when really it's just giving you good messages for kids. It's telling you don't be xenophobic. It's telling you to investigate and explore the natural world and to question authority. These are all good concepts to have because that makes you an independent thinker. But I do worry that people are going to take this and run with it as a political movie when really it's not. It's just a sweet little film about Yetis trying to live in harmony in the world. So overall, it's a nice movie, and it does have a good message, and I like that. I brought my 10-year-old. He really enjoyed it. My 10-year-old really wanted to see this movie, too, which surprised me, because I don't watch all the stuff he does, like on television necessarily, or online, but apparently it's heavily promoted, and it's getting some penetration in the marketplace. And yeah, some of the Yetis do kind of look like they're running around in a evening gown that Bea Arthur would be wearing in the Oscars in the 70s, but still, it's a beautifully done movie. It's a gorgeous movie, but pretty much all animated movies are gorgeous because, you know, that level of artistry exists. And it's the story that works. And there was nothing, I mean, it's not a great movie. It's not like one of my favorites. It's not going to top my year, but there was nothing in there that I had a problem with. That's usually what takes me out of an animated film. If I'm watching that and I go, I don't like that character, and I know this character's there for comic relief, but he really annoys me. I thought it all was still cohesive and worthwhile and something you can take the kids to and the family can love it. So I'm going to say that Smallfoot kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about Hellfest. A serial killer stalks a group of friends who attend a massive horror-themed carnival.
It's Halloween. I got us VIP passes to Hellfest.
What is that?
It's a traveling horror night. Has horror mazes in it. You will totally lose it in there. A couple years ago, some girl got totally gutted.
Killer left her body in the park for 3 days. They thought she was a freaking prop.
You came here to be scared, right? I can't arrest people for doing their job. Welcome to Hellfest.
Here we are at the end of September. We're rolling into October. October is Halloween month. Now, I know I have been doing horror movies for the last couple weeks. I love horror movies. Everybody knows that by now. Ironically, I can't actually review this because I didn't see it. So we're actually going a week leading into October in which I'm not actually going to fully review a horror movie. And that's okay. I will have plenty of horror movies to talk about in the next 3-4 weeks. But Hellfest, they didn't screen it. But that makes sense because it was Lionsgate does horror and Lionsgate doesn't always screen these movies. These are kind of critic proof. Horror fans are going to go see them whether or not they screen it. And it doesn't, they don't care what the New York Times film critic has to say about Hellfest. They're going to go see it regardless. This is a concept that's been done before. That's kind of the biggest weakness I see going into this. We saw this just a couple years ago with the Funhouse Massacre. And then, of course, you go back to the Funhouse, which is Tobe Hooper's slasher movie from 1981, as the same kind of idea where people are in the place that's supposed to get you scared and there's real killers in there. You know, even that Rob Zombie movie, 13, wasn't that 13? That awful film that came out a couple years ago. That kind of plays on a similar thing where it takes what would be a haunted house type experience and they put real people in that situation. So it's not like you're going to get anything new, but it's playing right to its audience. I imagine it's very gory. It's rated R. That's a good sign for horror fans because there's a lot of people that don't like the PG-13ification of horror films. And to a degree, I agree with them. I think some of them can be fun as PG-13, but a movie like Slender Man, I thought suffered from the fact that it was PG-13 because those tend to feel neutered and Slender Man could have been really creepy, but it just felt like another Blumhouse teen. What is now we're seeing with Blumhouse is the slasher films from the 80s, that sort of business model where they just kind of crank them out at $1 million or $2 million a piece. They don't spend much money on them and they make money, but they're really not good. You go back, you watch some of those slasher movies from the 80s and oh yeah, Halloween's great. Friday the 13th is pretty good. Prom Night's cool. But you start getting down the list and the more obscure ones, those don't tend to be great. They're more nostalgia at this point than they are actually good movies. So I didn't get to see Hellfest. They didn't screen it. I do want to see it. I may check it out this October. But for purposes of review, it wasn't screened, which means it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
And that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Old Man and the Gun, The Box Office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Solo, A Star Wars Story. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews with The Old Man and the Gun. Robert Redford plays a real-life character, Forrest Tucker, who politely robbed a series of banks across the United States.
Excuse me, I'd like to open up an account.
Well, great. What type of account do you have in mind?
This kind.
He said he was armed.
He was also sort of a gentleman.
He was very polite.
He seemed like a nice enough fella.
Look at that. Is he smiling?
5 states.
93 robberies.
In 2 years.
You think you can catch him?
Yeah, I won't lie. I'd love to slap the cuffs on him myself. So I hope I get the chance.
When I saw the name The Old Man and the Gun and knew it was a movie with Robert Redford in it, I was like, oh no, this is going to be a gun control movie. And it's not that I don't have an opinion about gun control. I don't want to be preached at. I don't like being preached at in the movies. If I want to go to get preached at, I'll go to church. I don't mind having a movie that has political themes to it, but I didn't want to have a movie that was so clearly about one issue. Then I went and saw this movie and I'm like, oh, this has nothing to do with gun control. And it was kind of a relief. That kind of like lifted my spirits when I realized, oh, this isn't at all about guns. But you put the word gun in a movie and you know it's going to be a polarizing thing. I mean, it involves guns, but that's not what it's about. It's about this guy, a real life character. There's a guy who actually was Forrest Tucker who went around and he escaped jail and would go and rob banks. And he was known as like this polite guy. He'd go up and he's very pleasant about it. He wasn't setting off the alarms or freaking people out. I mean, yeah, sure, it's unnerving to be robbed in a bank setting, and it's unnerving to have somebody have a weapon in front of you that could be used to kill you. But he was always very nice about it, and that's kind of the character he plays. The other thing that's worth noting is this is Robert Redford, supposedly his last film. But we all know that, you know, farewell tours don't always mean that they're done. I mean, how many times has Cher quit? I mean, wasn't she supposed to have a farewell tour in the 90s? And she's still showing up and stuff. But yeah, this is supposed to be Robert Redford's final film before he retires from acting. I think about 10 years ago was a good time for him to retire from acting, but he's insisting on continuing. His last 10 years haven't been great stuff. They've been okay, but probably his last really decent movie was about, 5 years ago with All Is Lost. And then everything since then has been him just getting an excuse to make a movie. Now, with this film, it's an interesting enough movie. It's a well-made movie in terms of acting. I mean, it's very charming. He's charming in it, and he has a romance with Sissy Spacek, and she's charming in this movie. Actually, I think she's really good in this movie. She's the standout performance. Sissy Spacek, to me, is what kind of makes this movie click, more so than Robert Redford, because Robert Redford's basically playing himself. Sissy Spacek is playing the woman that he kind of has a little fling with, and she's great in the movie. I wish there was more of her in it. You also have Casey Affleck, who plays the detective who's chasing after him. And Casey Affleck, he's kind of gone downhill in terms of once he won the Oscar, you know, since then he's just been moping in his movies. And I'm not a big Casey Affleck fan at this point. And I think he doesn't break out of that at all. So he's not worth watching in this film. But I mean, overall, it's a decent enough movie. It's charming. It's directed by David Lowery, who's done, like, he did a ghost story. That's the one with Casey Affleck last year as the guy, the ghost in the sheet. He also did Pete's Dragon, the remake of Pete's Dragon, which I actually thought was pretty good. But David Lowery has a much more subdued, reserved, slow approach. And that works for this movie, especially since it's about old people, the old man and the gun. And Sissy Spacek, who's up there in age too. And I will say that it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Last week was a win for The House with a Clock in Its Walls. The House with a Clock in Its Walls actually overperformed it. I mean, it wasn't a huge hit. It didn't make $100 million, but it made almost $27 million, and they were expecting low 20s for this one. This is going to do well. I think it's going to have legs through October. And it's sort of like what we saw with Goosebumps, the original Goosebumps movie a couple of years ago with Jack Black, that people were sort of downplaying it, and it did better. Fahrenheit 11.9 came in at only 8 with $3 million, which is not good for a Michael Moore movie. And then Life Itself was outside of the top 10, which is kind of alarming, with just over $2 million. And aside from, you know, a nice hold that's continuing on with Crazy Rich Asians, you're not getting a whole lot of buzz going on in the box office from last weekend. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is on Solo, a Star Wars story. Ron Howard directs this story, which chronicles a young Han Solo as he's getting into the smuggling business.
I've been running scams on the street since I was 10. I was kicked out of the flight academy for having a mind of my own. I'm going to be a pilot.
Hey, kid. I'm putting together a crew. You in?
That's yes.
I liked this movie in the theaters. I was very happy to get a chance to revisit it on Blu-ray. My opinion hasn't changed of the movie. I liked this film. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was energetic and exciting. But it gave me a chance now knowing that it played a little softer. And when I say softer, this movie made about $400 million worldwide. That's not a failure. That's still plenty of people seeing it. But this film wasn't the billion-dollar juggernaut that the other Star Wars movies were. And having already seen it and known the box office performance, being able to watch it again with that gave me a chance to kind of re-examine what I think worked and what didn't, and why it didn't do as well. And there are some people who came out, I remember there's an article that said, we've definitively said it's because it wasn't marketed right, which is always what people in the business say, because that's something you have control over. They feel that marketing can make or break a movie, and that's not true. Marketing can help a movie along, but there has to be an interest in it. And I think there are two big reasons why Solo struggled. The first one was not Star Wars fatigue, but I think a little bit of blowback from The Last Jedi. The Last Jedi was a very polarizing movie, and it soured. I've talked to people just out there in everyday life, and I know there are people that were soured to Star Wars because of that. They didn't like it. And I go back and look at that movie, The Last Jedi, and even though I've revisited it, it still leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And part of the reason, I think, is because it was trying to so differentiate itself and so break down the existing histories that it kind of ruined some of the characters, that the characters weren't good at what they were doing. And they were your heroes before, and they become not your heroes in the new one. And I know that's part of the point of Rian Johnson, but that's not the point of making that movie. And I think that caused people to sour on Star Wars in general. And then it came out only like 5 months afterwards. So not only was it coming out after a polarizing Star Wars movie, it came out so soon that there was a certain saturation in the market. I also think it's not a necessary movie. I enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun, but you could never see this movie and you would still be able to follow all the other films. There's nothing in this movie that happens that's critical to the story, and that's okay. You shouldn't have that. It's sort of like the Marvel TV shows. You should be able to go watch the Marvel movies and catch up on all of them and understand what's going on without having to watch Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Iron Fist and Luke Cage on Netflix. Or when Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was on. That shouldn't have been required viewing, because that's a much bigger time commitment in a totally different setting than the movies. And that's essentially the way Solo was. I mean, it's still a great movie, a lot of fun, but there's nothing about it that's critical to watch. And then the final thing is Emilia Clarke. There's not a whole lot you can do with her character because she's not in A New Hope and they never reference her ever again. So you know that storyline doesn't continue. And it's unlike Rogue One, where you knew everyone was going to die because they told you everyone was going to die in A New Hope. So yeah, Solo I still enjoyed. And the Blu-ray comes with a whole other disc of bonus features, which is great because I love that kind of stuff. And they have like a roundtable discussion, and they have looking at the writing and the different scenes, like the train heist and how they develop things like Chewbacca and the droid and the Millennium Falcon. And they have just a bunch of extra stuff, including deleted scenes and a little bit of behind the scenes stuff, which is great. I love when you have that whole separate disc that's like 2 hours or so of content. So it's good to buy just for that alone. Still, I'm going to say, even with its foibles, Solo still rocked.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other movies this week that are out on DVD and Blu-ray include Uncle Drew, Gotti, and DC's Legends of Tomorrow Season 3. And that is it for the week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about A Star is Born and Venom. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.